You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, back in the studio, sitting in my chair, gently, but live. Oh, my, it's great to be back. Yeah, the Republicans seem to be having a bit of a conversation with Gaia, you know, the goddess of the earth down there in Tampa right now. It looks like she had the better of the say, as is usually the case when you try to take on Mother Nature. And in the opinion of many of us, and hopefully some of the Republicans will get this message, Mother Earth seems to be saying, you know, all that money you're taking from the fossil fuel industry, the so-called clean coal, and not just you, by the way, but all the TV networks that are down there covering you and sucking up to you and all that kind of stuff. They're taking that same money in the form of hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising for clean coal and clean gas and fracking and offshore drilling. And isn't it wonderful? And we're fixing the Gulf and quack, 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 quack. We are not amused. Can you just imagine, you know, Queen Elizabeth as Gaia, as Mother Earth? We are not amused. So we will send a hurricane your way. Well, anyway, it shut down the first day. They'll be back tomorrow. Nothing stops them. You know, it's like cockroaches. Nothing stops them. Some pretty amazing stuff going on, though. The Federal Election Commission. Now, this was the result of three Republican FEC commissioners. But the Federal Election Commission has ruled that if you work for a corporation, and in this case the corporation was a union, but this has to do with employees. Unions typically have very few employees, you know, a few dozen maybe at the most. A larger union may have a few hundred employees, but mostly they have members. Right? And this isn't about union members. This apply, and unions are corporations, so this is about corporations. So corporations don't have members, they have employees. And what they ruled is that if the corporation that you work for decides that you have to go out door to door and hand out Mitt Romney literature, or you lose your job, that's what you've got to do. Even if your job description is telephone lineman, or electrical engineer, or burger flipper, or rocket scientist, or clerk at the bank, it doesn't matter. If you don't participate in electioneering, then under Citizens United, here's the actual ruling. The GOP commissioners found that the current law and regulations do not prohibit employees from requiring participation. This is from Igor Volsky, wrote it over at Think Progress blog. Here's the quote from the ruling. UPW's independent use of its paid workforce to campaign for a federal candidate post Citizens United was not contemplated by Congress and consequently is not prohibited by either the Act or Commission regulations. Requiring employees to work on independent expenditures for either the union or a non-connected political committee is not a violation of the Act or Commission regulations. You get it? This is how far, and this is Citizens United. This is how far Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and the our wackadoodle Supreme Court, this is how far they've taken us. That a corporation can now say, well, you know, we're going to take the last 3 weeks of October and the first week of November off. Everybody's still paid. Because we got a different job for you to do. Instead of your normal job of sitting there and answering the phone and taking orders for Mr. Speedy cleanup kits or whatever, you're going to be phone banking, calling, you know, Mormons for Romney or something. And here's the script you're going to have to read, and this is what you're going to have to do. The question in my mind is if the employees are doing it on paid time, which is what the Supreme Court has apparently allowed here under Citizens United, can the employer continue to deduct the cost of the employees as a cost of doing business? And I'm guessing the answer is no, because the UPW actually paid a civil penalty of $5,500 for failing to report independent expenditures in support of a federal candidate. So apparently the labor that is put in is considered a federal, is considered a an independent expenditure. But nothing in Citizens United, this is, again, writing from the thing. After citizen writing from the FEC's statement, you know, after Citizens United, UPW had every right to expressly advocate for its chosen candidate and against her opponent. Nothing in Citizens United suggests, however, that the court intended to expand the rights of corporations and unions at the expense of their employees' longstanding rights to be free from coercion and to express or decline or express their own political views. Now, that was a separate statement made by the three Democratic commissioners saying, hey, wait a minute, this ain't right. But the Republicans prevailed. What would you do if your employer said, guess what? You're going to be phone banking for the next 3 days. Or something like that. Okay, other things in the news. There's a lot going on. We've got a whole variety of guests. In fact, in our third hour, Michael Grunewald is going to be with us. He's the senior national correspondent of Time Magazine and author of The New New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And it's a mind-boggling article, or a book, actually. And I had a half-hour conversation with this guy last week or the week before. I guess it was the week before. It might have been several weeks ago now. The last few weeks have all blurred together in my brain with the surgery and painkillers and all the time I spent in the ER and all that other kind of crap. Anyhow, I had this conversation with Michael Grunewald, and it really impressed me. And I said, we've got to get him on the radio and talk about this. So that's going to be in our third hour. In our second hour, Jay Timmons, president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers, is going to be on. Hey, isn't it time to bring our jobs home? We'll see what they have to say, because they tend to be rather Republican in their perspective. And Tony Sayup, who is a political analyst and campaign management consultant, government affairs professional, with, quote, thehappyright.com, give you a clue. We're going to discuss, do Americans really want the rich to pay more taxes? The Republicans don't think so. You know, Paul Ryan's tax plan would reduce Mitt Romney's taxes down to 1% of his income instead of 13% of his income. But if you're making less than $60,000 or $80,000 a year, it would raise your taxes. In fact, if you're making less than $50,000 a year and you have a family, it would radically raise your taxes. That's the Paul Ryan plan. That's the Republican plan. Raise taxes on the working people, cut taxes on the very rich. Cut them a lot. I mean, Mitt Romney's taxes would literally go to 1%, or maybe even a fraction of 1%. Okay, a couple other things here. I've just got a whole pile of things here, but we can also. It's summertime, so we'll just do this as anything goes, whatever. We'll pick up calls after the bottom of the hour, and when we don't have a guest, which will be at the bottom of the hour. And I got to tell you, Jefferson warned us about standing armies. They just busted up a plot within the U.S. Army of active Army soldiers plotting to assassinate the President of the United States. I'll tell you about that and about Mitt Romney coming right out and saying his campaign, welfare is the base of Obama.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, you know, they're trying to play it like the race card. I mean, most people on welfare, 60% of people on welfare are white, but the Romney people are trying to play it like the race card. It's amazing. Just saying. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. Oh, man. It is incredible. I've got to share these Thomas Jefferson quotes with you. He predicted what is happening in our military right now. He predicted it in 1787. We will get to that in a few minutes. Mitt Romney says his campaign now is coming right out and saying welfare recipients make up President Obama's political base. Right. Nobody told any of these people 60% of welfare recipients are white. So, you know, the super subtext of this. But anyhow, meanwhile, John Nichols, the Washington correspondent for The Nation, is live from Tampa. Hey, John, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, it's great to be with you. I'm just watching Mitch McConnell walk by. They're all here.
Yeah, kick him in the...
I'm not going to do that. It would wreck our interview. It's not worth it.
I'm not going any further with that one.
I agree.
The real role, Paul Ryan, the real party. You know, you're in a unique position to know about Paul Ryan because he's from your state, Wisconsin. So
that is true. Yeah.
So tell me what, you know, what is the Nichols uprising? What is going on here? Excuse me, that's the Twitter at Nichols uprising. What is the real Paul Ryan? Who is the real Paul Ryan? And how can we expect him to influence this ticket and the governing of this nation?
Well, that's the core question, because Ryan is the dynamic figure of this convention. I've been down here for the last couple days, gone to all kinds of events, Tea Party events, mainstream Republican events, even relatively moderate Republican events. And you mentioned Romney's name, and there's barely a ripple. You mentioned Ryan's name, and they're on their feet cheering.
Yeah.
So he's clearly the one they're excited about. So who is he? Well, bottom line is that Paul Ryan is a child of privilege, born into a very, very multi-generational wealthy family who has had his way paved for him pretty much from birth. Now, that doesn't mean he hasn't had some tough moments in his life. His father died when he was a teenager, and that's terrible and difficult. But the way to understand...
As a result of that?
What's that?
Didn't he get Social Security as a result of that?
Yeah, and of course he had plenty of money to go to college. So he banked the checks for beer money and other stuff.
Yeah.
But the way to understand him is that when he finished college, he was given a position as a Republican aide in Washington. He went out to D.C. He worked for Bill Bennett and Jack Kemp and Gene Kirkpatrick, all of the sort of hanger-on Reaganites, really, and was with them from the age of about 22 to 27. When a congressional seat opened in Wisconsin, they used their connections. And I want to emphasize, Newt Gingrich and others came down heavy on the party and said, you clear that primary, we want this young man in Congress. So he got elected to Congress with no primary and essentially a very, very soft general election, huge amounts of money. And he's been in Congress ever since.
Wow.
So that's the core of the guy. I'm not cast aspersions here, but essentially he's a made man in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and a child of wealth and somebody who's never seen or experienced the kinds of hardships that by his policies would inflict on at least a third of the nation. I'm curious, John, your thoughts on this story that's going around that basically the Koch brothers bought his vice presidency, their guy, and they put him in. Either by putting money in or by the threat of withholding money, and maybe not just the Koch brothers, but, you know, that he's the billionaire's guy.
Yeah, there's no question. He is the billionaire's guy. So let's begin there and, you know, build the base for making.
And that he may well be there not even to win this election. He may be there to be the presidential candidate in 2016.
Or to advance a set of ideas that they find more important than actually holding power. Because if they can implant their ideas sufficiently, it doesn't matter who's in power. They will buy into the fantasy that we have to radically alter our entitlement programs, not so that they go away. That's the important thing to understand. So that they begin to stream revenue from Social Security into Wall Street speculators and from Medicare into the insurance company.
Right, and we've seen this
guy who takes care.
We've seen this alteration of the political gestalt before. We saw it when. You know, with Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, and it was contagious. I mean, Bill Clinton caught a bunch of it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so you asked the core question, you know, do the Kochs make this guy? And one thing to understand is that the Koch brothers have been among his top five or six contributors throughout his career, going way back to the start. I mean, you know, we all talk about the Kochs now. He knew who the Kochs were 12, 15 years ago.
Right.
And so they've always donated to him. They have always loved him. He has always spoken their language. And so this notion that the Kochs, as has been suggested by Roger Stone, a longtime Republican aide, that the Kochs actually forced him on the ticket, I think that it's probably one that you'd want to generalize out and say that Wall Street, portions of Wall Street, and portions of the big money class that is very, very dominant in the Republican Party clearly wanted Paul Ryan on this ticket.
Yeah. So he's the fat cat's guys.
And they did not trust Mitt Romney to have the depth or the focus to see this thing through. Remember, Mitt Romney, for all of, you know, his conservative talk of late, he has throughout his career shown at least a bow of the hat to moderation, and he's not always on message. And so I think it became absolutely true in July and August when the Republican Party was starting to wake up to the reality that Mitt Romney could well lose this race. In fact, his poll numbers were looking bad. There's a lot of discomfort with decisions he was making. I think there was a point there where a lot of the money establishment said, look, this is not about the Republican Party. This is about us. We own this party. And we want somebody that we have absolute confidence in on that ticket.
Yeah.
And that person is Paul Ryan.
Amazing. Paul Ryan, the man in the top hat without the top hat, the $600 bottle of wine guy. Thank you so much.
Right.
John Nichols, live from Tampa, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Much appreciated and great to hear from you. We will be back with more. I gotta share with you this military conspiracy. It's incredible. You know Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And so back to this militia. This four army soldiers. This is from Huffington Post's Crime Watch by Russ Bynum. Four Army soldiers based in southeast Georgia killed a former comrade and his girlfriend. They murdered one of their own and his girlfriend because they were going to blow the whistle on this thing. The lead is actually buried. In my opinion, the lead is the very one of the last paragraphs. The group, the militia group, had big plans and plotted to take over Fort Stewart, bombing the Forsyth Park Fountain in nearby Savannah in Washington State. The group plotted to bomb a dam and poison the state's apple crop. Ultimately, prosecutors said the militia's goal was to overthrow the government and assassinate the president. This is what's growing inside the United States military right now. And they killed two of their own people back in December. I mean, you know, more than half a year ago, it took a while for the ACIS or whatever it is, whatever the Army Crime Service, whatever it is, whoever investigated it, to find this. Now, Jefferson was very, very clear about this, that having standing armies during times of peace was a danger to the Republic, that countries were overthrown by people within their standing armies, that if you had a time of peace, you had a bunch of soldiers sitting around cleaning their guns, and some of them are malcontents, they might get together and say, you know, let's take over this damn government. Let's shoot the president. Literally, that's what these guys were planning on doing. And let's have a military coup. And, we remember, there have been so many of them, right? Pinochet. I should have a list. Actually, Pinochet comes to mind. I don't know. Shane, you got any? You can come up with it. There was one in Argentina. I forget his name. It's been coup after coup after coup, actually, all over the world. You see these military coups. And this was something that, you know, back in the day, Jefferson certainly saw and said, no, we don't want. We don't want this. We don't want military coups in the United States. We don't want a standing army. In fact, here's a quote. This is a letter that he wrote to David Humphreys in 1793. There are instruments so dangerous to the rights of a nation and which place them so totally at the mercy of their governors that those governors, whether legislative or executive, should be restrained from keeping such instruments on foot, but in well-defined cases. Such an instrument is a standing army. Now, in that case, Jefferson was expressing his concern that the army might turn its guns on the people themselves. In other words, the country would become despotic if you had a standing army. At different times, he expressed these two different opinions. One is that the country itself could become a despotic place if you had a standing army. At other times, he said the standing army itself represented a danger to the country. Here's another one. This is his first annual message. This is his State of the Union address, 1801. His first, he was elected in the election of 1800, president of the United States. He says, "Nor is it conceived needful or safe that a standing army should be kept up in times of peace for defense against invasion." Now, at that time, there were 300,000 men in the U.S. Army, and he cut it down to 3,000 by the time he left office 6 years later, 8 years later. Here's another one. Standing armies are in... This is a reply to Lord North's proposition, 1775. "Standing armies are inconsistent with a people's freedom and subversive of their quiet." And then to Chandler Price in 1807, when he was president of the United States, President of the United States Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The spirit of this country is totally adverse to a large military force." So what does Mitt Romney want to do? He wants to massively increase the military budget. So much so, without any details, that the military analysts who like look at this kind of thing for a living, they can't figure out where he's going to put all the money. It doesn't make any sense. Well, you know, all this money that Romney, keep in mind, the military budget has tripled since 1997. Tripled. It is the largest chunk of discretionary spending within the U.S. budget. It's more than half. In fact, it's almost 60%, I believe. And Romney wants to increase it even more. And the military is looking at it going, "We don't know what we do with this." I mean, we're winding down wars right now. Romney wants to add 100,000 soldiers. Obama's like saying to guys who've been, you know, doing 3 and 4 tours of duty, "Okay, fine, you can go home now." Incredible. But then the thing that I think is most despicable, and this is genuinely despicable. Is the back when Bill Clinton changed the AFDC program, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, which was part of Social Security. And it used to be that if you were a family with dependent children and you were unable to work or unable to get a job, you were entitled to essentially Social Security benefits or a form of Social Security benefits. And this was called Newt Care at the time. Newt Gingrich came along with this idea of, why don't we time limit this? Why don't we call it temporary assistance to needy families, TANF, and just do away with the aid to families with dependent children. And we'll time limit it for 5 years. At the end of 5 years, if people haven't found a job, to hell with them, they don't get any more money. And Gingrich pushed this through Congress and pushed it onto President Clinton's desk. Clinton ultimately, you know, embraced it in saying, you know, we've ended welfare as we know it, all that kind of thing. But frankly, it was just the political thing he had to do. I mean, Gingrich had done such a good sales job on this thing. And if it's really easy to find a job, and you're not genuinely disabled, you're just unemployed, or living in an area of high unemployment, then, you know, there's a certain kind of logic to, okay, you know, if you don't get a job within a couple of years, we're not going to help you anymore. But what about when unemployment's at 8.2% and has been, you know, and we've been adding private sector jobs for 24 straight months, but, you know, it's still, we're in a Great Depression. And when George Bush left, we were in an extreme Great Depression. And at that point, such a program doesn't work so well. So what Obama said to a couple of states was, if you want to experiment in ways that will improve this program, feel free. We will provide you with a waiver on the program so that you, and in most cases it was Republican governors. Keep in mind, it's the Republican states that use the most welfare benefits. The Republican states take the most out of the federal government. The Democratic states put the most money in. The Republican states take the most money out. So Obama was saying to Republican governors, if you can figure out a better way to make this work, fine, we'll give you a waiver on the program. You can try it out. It was limited. It was a trial. And it had nothing to do with ending welfare to work. So Romney comes out with this lie, and there's no other way to describe it than as that, as a lie. And is falsely accusing the president of removing the work requirement from welfare. Now, first of all, I wouldn't be opposed to that at all. I think we should go back to AFDC or some variation of it. The TANF program works when you're in an economic boom, but not in an economic bust. But that said, it's not what Obama did. And Obama and what Romney is really saying is, and in fact, one of his campaign people said today, the welfare recipients make up President Obama's political base. And as I said earlier, they're saying welfare recipients, when you're talking to white middle class voters, is code for black people. Even though 60 some odd percent of all welfare recipients are white people, it doesn't matter. They don't know it. Right. This has got to be one of the most despicable campaigns I have ever, ever seen. Judy in Toronto, Canada. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hi, I was just wondering why when everybody on the media, you know, POTUS and Left and MSNBC are interviewing all these Republican governors who are thanking FEMA for coming in and helping them out after Katrina, and how the levees are now up to date because of the Army Corps of Engineers. But they're not asking these Republicans that why they're not commenting on the fact that Republicans want to cancel FEMA.
Right.
And want to cancel the Army Corps of Engineers.
Or the big government put this all together and made it work.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's. I would love to see a question. You know, this big government program here of reinforcing these levees seems to have worked. You know, Governor Jindal, what do you think?
Well, I've a big government. Maybe it's not.
It's a pretty strange thing. It's a pretty strange thing, Judy. And it is an opportunity. This is a learning opportunity. I mean, just thank you for the call. Just the fact that Tampa knows that the storm is coming. It's because of the National Weather Service, which is paid for out of the federal budget, that Paul Ryan wants to cut. He wants to cut the number of weather stations out there detecting things like the storm that's coming to Tampa that's taking out the Republican convention. These people are idiots. I don't have another word for it. I mean, I do, but I can't say them on the radio, so we'll go with idiots.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is truly extraordinary. And let's check in with the right wing and see what they have to say about this. Right after this.
I'm back in the saddle again. Out where a friend is a friend. Where the longhorn cattle feed on the lowly gypsum wheat. Back in the saddle again.
Yes, welcome back. I'm here, sitting in my chair. The first time in 3 weeks. Holy cow, time flies. It is so good to be back. Tony, is it Sayeg, Tony?
That's me, Tom. Great to be with you.
Great to have you with us. I'm sorry I didn't have ultimately, I did have the pronunciation of your name right. But you're a political news analyst, campaign management consultant, government affairs professional. The website, thehappyright.com, which would incline me to suspect that you are part of the Happy Right.
Indeed I am.
Okay.
Lots to be happy about today, that's for sure.
So Americans want the rich to pay more taxes. And you guys, you know, Paul Ryan wants Mitt Romney's tax rate to go from 13% down to 1%. and all the guys on Wall Street, their tax rate to go down to 0%. First of all, why?
Well, first of all, Tom, it really is great to be on your show. I am a fan, even though we don't necessarily agree, and this initial question is a perfect reflection as to why. You know, this notion that we don't have a very progressive tax code already is a total liberal canard. The top 0.1% pay more in federal income taxes than the lower 80%.
The top 0.1% of the United States owns 40% of all the wealth in this country.
That's another canard as well, that it's all concentrated among the top 1%. This is the problem. This
400 wealthy, the Forbes 400. This is not a canard. It's in Forbes magazine. The Forbes 400 people own half the wealth in America.
And they pay more taxes than the lower 80%. So even if I accept your number.
And 100 of those 400 people paid no taxes whatsoever in any of the last 5 years.
Which is the exact
right. And you can find
right,
that in
which
Forbes
is the
magazine.
Right case. Which, by the way, is the exact reason there's a strong case for real tax reform, which will get everybody paying their fair share and eliminate loopholes and deductions.
Yeah, but
that's
when you guys
exactly
say real tax
what
reform.
What Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney have been talking about, as have most Republicans. Listen, the other issue you cannot escape is the fact that even if you did raise these taxes, you're going to fund the federal government for an additional 6 weeks. It's not as if this is going to be the panacea that's going to solve our nation's debt and deficit problems.
Well, then how is it that we had a surplus when Bill Clinton was president?
Well, Bill Clinton cut the capital gains taxes, Tom. Your argument doesn't hold water with him.
But
he actually cut the capital gains rates.
It was only 5% that he cut the capital gains
rate. He cut them enough to stimulate growth because capital in the hands of individuals is best to be reinvested into our economy and grow the economy.
So you
the
think that was
Obama
responsible
model,
for the .com boom, not the invention of the Internet?
Well, the Internet certainly had a lot to do with it, but how about the funders who actually put money behind the enterprises
but Bill
that went
Clinton
and took
raised
the risk to
taxes
to
on rich people by 3%, and you guys are all hysterical about it. He balanced the budget. I mean,
today
you've got six people, the six Walton heirs to the Walmart fortune. They own, you see, six people own more than the bottom 30% of all Americans. How can that be a healthy thing for a nation?
Biggest funders when he was governor of Arkansas and ultimately became president. Listen,
and his wife was on the board of Walmart. But how can that be a good thing for the nation?
Ultimately, the only thing that's going to solve this problem of income inequity in America is a growing economy. Raising taxes on rich people does not grow the economy. You could certainly make...
When we had highest taxes on rich people, we had the fastest growing economy.
That's actually not correct. The fastest growing economy we had was during John Kennedy when he cut top marginal rates drastically.
You had one of the worst recessions since the Great Depression during Ronald Reagan. And if you look at decades, when he borrowed $2 trillion, just borrowed it, put it on the credit card, no plan to ever pay it back. We're still trying to pay it back and spend it on Star Wars. Of course, you give me $2
You're talking about money spent fighting the Cold War. I mean, you're talking about Barack Obama in 4 years who spent $6.5 trillion.
If you look at the 50s and if you look at the decade of the 60s and you look at the decade of the 70s, those are the only three decades in the history of the United States when GDP consistently over a 10-year period was above 3.2%, highest in history. And those three decades, the top tax rate on wealthy individuals after they had earned their first $1 million was between 91% and 74%.
The economy grows best when the private sector is liberated to reinvest its capital.
Not true.
Not when government redistributes it. You know what? Look, you and I could say not true. Yes, you know, my point's right, your point's right. At the end of the day,
Where is this Reagan prosperity? We've had Reaganomics for 30 years and the middle class is in the toilet. Where is this prosperity that's come about as a result of your theories?
No, the toilet that the middle class finds itself in is largely due to the fact that the unions have made it so uncompetitive to actually create jobs.
The unions have gone
related jobs
30% of the U.S.
country.
Workforce when Reagan came into office to 7% of the private workforce
still,
now. And you're going to try and blame us on them?
They still run a lot of states where they don't have right-to-work laws. They still have a whole lot of influence
right to work for
over
less
the
laws.
Democratic Party. Well, those states are where you have fair wages, you have growing economies, and you have low unemployment and high quality of life. You can call it what
come on,
you
that's
want,
nonsense.
When,
you know
it's
that
it's not nonsense.
That,
it's not
the,
nonsense.
That the 25...
Go look at the statistics. You like the statistics, right? You like facts. Go look and compare the balance, the budgets, and standards of living in right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states. It's much more advantageous to live in a state that has right-to-work laws.
What you will find is that those states, we've seen this experiment now for 3 years, in those states where you've got those 25 states where you've got Republican governors who have cut spending and who have cut taxes, you've actually seen unemployment go up and GDP go down. In those 25 states where you've got Democratic governors and legislatures, where you have seen an increase in taxes and an increase in spending, you have seen an increase in employment and a decrease increase in GDP.
They're not growing.
The biggest problem California has is that right wing proposal that was put on that requires a supermajority in the whatever they call it, the General Assembly to raise taxes.
California,
you guys hobbled the state, and now you're sitting around good looking. Look at this. The state is hobbled.
California makes financially stable. There hasn't been a Republican governor in California, if you consider Schwarzenegger a real Republican, since Pete Wilson. I mean, Schwarzenegger has been operating as much a liberal or moderate Democrat as you possibly
could find. Come on.
Look, at the end of the day, you have to respect individual achievement and private property rights.
Well, I do. I absolutely respect individual achievement and private property rights. Tony Sayek and thehappyright.com is the website. Tony, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. Live from Tampa.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and pleased to be here. It is raining in Tampa. Mother Nature saying to the Republicans, well, maybe you shouldn't have taken all that oil money. You'd think they'd get the message. You would think they would get the message. But so far, not. Mark, listening on WCPT in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Maybe the reason those right-to-work states have such a higher standard of living is they got more billionaires now, you know? Everybody else is poor, so now some of the averages look a little higher, you know what I mean?
It may well be. Figures don't lie, but liars can figure. What we do know is that in right-to-work for less states, average working people make less money. I mean, I can say that as an absolute statement of fact. You may have more billionaires, you may have more rich people, but the average working person is screwed in a right-to-work-for-less state. It's that simple.
That's not what I want to talk to you about. What I want to tell you is this, that the reason the Republicans want a large military budget is because what they want to do is that's a way to run a big deficit. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And when they run a big deficit, what happens is that the government is forced to privatize. That's what they're really after.
Yep. Well, and not only that, then they can do this to Santa Claus theory. Then if a Democrat comes into office, if a Democrat gets into the White House, they can start screaming about the deficit. I mean, this has been going on since 1980. Jude Winiski proposed this in 1976 with his two Santa Claus theory, and they have been doing this religiously since 1980, since the Reagan presidency, and that is that when a Republican is in the White House, you run up the debt as hard as you can, as far as you can, as fast as you can, and as permanently as you can. You put into place things like, you know, Medicare Part D or wars or things that somebody can't just come into office and turn off the next day, right? And then when a Democrat comes into office, you know, you stop talking about everything else and you start screaming about the debt, which forces the Democrat to look for ways to cut the debt. The Republicans refuse to raise taxes. So then the Democrat has to shoot Santa Claus. He has to go after some of the social programs, either that or shoot the military budget, which is something that pretty much both parties are loath to do. So I'm totally with you, Mark. The Republicans want a deficit. They love a deficit, and they are largely responsible for our deficit. And you know, it wouldn't be there without them. If we had sent, you know, if George Bush had simply stayed the course with Bill Clinton, we would not have a deficit right now. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Santa Rosa, California. John, hey, John, how you doing today?
I'm fine, Tom, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Hey, I just want to make a comment about the voter suppression that's going on around the country.
Uh-huh.
It seems this is a country that if you want something to resonate, you've got to create a catchphrase or something that can reduce down to a bumper sticker. Why don't we call this voter suppression, why don't we call it affirmative action for Republicans? And I don't think that's hyperbole. That's really what it is.
Yeah, it's worse than that. It's because it's
you're right. It is worse than that. I would call it electoral welfare.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they buy and lie. It's amazing. I was over the weekend. I was talking to an old friend of mine. He and I were business partners, in fact, back in the 70s, a fellow by the name of Terry. And he lives down in the Florida Keys and you know, just called and we were having this conversation. And he said, oh, by the way, I went down to get my driver's license renewed so I'd have, you know, my ID to vote because it's about to expire. And he said, they wouldn't take my old driver's license and renew it. He said, they made me go home and I had to get my birth certificate and I had to have four different kinds of ID and I had to have two letters from financial institutions showing that I actually lived where I live. And, you know, fortunately, Terry has got a couple of checking accounts and a savings account, but I'll bet you there's a lot of people in the state of Florida who don't.
And I wonder if he might have had an easier time of it if he had, say, brought a gun license instead.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't think the average clerk is the villain here. You know, it's the law. It's very much the law.
It is the law. I mean, this is the anti-affirmative action party, and yet the only way they can win elections is by disenfranchising legitimate taxpaying Americans because they can't win on the merits of their politics.
Yes, in fact, when people understand their politics, they get horrified by them. So. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
well, that was my comment anyway.
Okay, well said, John. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Mark in Longview, Washington. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say I think maybe it should be illegal for any company, corporation, or U.S. citizen, even if they have dual citizenship, to have bank accounts in different countries because, you know, that people are doing this to avoid paying their taxes.
Yeah. Why don't we, instead of saying you can't have a Swiss bank account, say if you have a Swiss bank account, it gets treated for tax purposes as if it was a Toledo, Ohio bank account.
Oh, yeah, that would work, too.
Yeah, and that way that's a little less of a restriction on, you know, freedoms,
yeah,
you know, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I'm with you. I'm absolutely with you. You know, Mitt Romney's using Swiss and Cayman accounts to play games with his taxes, particularly for his 401k and the $100 million that he set aside for his kids. And, you know, rich people do this all the time, and it is wrong, in my opinion. It's not something we should be doing. Mark, thank you very much. We got plenty of good banks in this country. Thank you very much. And even, and I'm not talking about the big six, and even beyond that, we got a heck of a lot of very, very good credit unions. We should be paying attention to them, and we should be giving them, you know, our support, as it were, rather than allowing this offshore nonsense. William in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, William, what's up?
Tom, I'm at work right now. I'm a longshoreman, okay? Pennsylvania is a right-to-work state. On the waterfront, we're now surrounded by scab labor. I make $24.50 an hour, okay? My scab labor that works right next door to me in these facilities, they make $7.50. Right now, my union is trying to put together with the PRPA that these companies should have to at least pay area standard wages, okay?
Right.
Because what they're doing, they're living off the government dole, getting breaks for the peers that they're leasing out, okay? So when you talk about right to work, it's about right to work for less,
yep,
less money. And we're dealing with this scab labor all around us in the ILA, and you know, right to work, and we're, you know, we're being buried by them because what happens is these guys, they're afraid to get them out of some type of a labor pool. They have no rights. They got to stay in the hull of a ship all day long with no break. They treat them like animals, giving them a sandwich. You know, it's bug because we do all kind of freight with pesticides on it, bugs on it. That's why we get paid the money, okay?
Right.
These guys, this is like it's like something out of Afghanistan or
Somalia. Like something out of a Dickens story, you know, the Christmas Carol or something.
It's really going on within the borders of Philadelphia right now. We had a guy come to our local, a Puerto Rican guy, gave our union president his pay stub. My union president took it right upstairs to the PRPA and showed them this. And they said, you know, we gotta do something about this. This is like, we're a union. We can't sit around and watch people be exploited like this. And yes, you know, we work in inclement weather, okay? And they get these guys, put it this way, they don't care if they die. They just get a, like right now, I'm on break. I'm a crane operator. I get a break, okay? They just work these guys to death, and you better not come out that crane or you're fired. You better not come out that hole or you're fired.
Because they don't have a union protecting them.
They have no union protecting. As a matter of fact, if they get close, like when a company has to legally pay benefits, I think that's like 90 days, they just walk up to them and say, we no longer need you. Matter of fact, one of these peers about 4 years ago, shot one of the supervisors.
Yeah.
Shot him in the head, man. Wow. I mean, you know, it's a shame. I am not advocating no violence.
No, of course
I'm just
not.
Glad I'm in a union and I make a decent wage. I am so glad. I mean, I'm so good because I'm so glad.
We've got to flip these right to work for less states back to union states. That we really have to do. William, thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
More of your calls and thoughts. Well, actually, we've got a guest here, Jay Timmons, coming on, the president and CEO of the National Association of Manufacturers, right after the break. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have a live connection throughout the show, and we will tomorrow and the day after through Talk Radio News Service. They actually built a studio for us at both the DNC and the RNC. I was originally going to be at both, but because my surgery got botched and I ended up in the ER and out of commission for a couple of weeks, I'm doing it from here. So we're bringing guests in live via those, you know, the internet and whatnot from that. But our current guest has no-showed. So let's pick up some of your calls here. Maureen in Britton, South Dakota, you wanted to talk about temporary assistance to needy families. That is what the acronym stands for, isn't it, Maureen?
Yes. I'm not real familiar with it. I don't have children of my own or anything, but I have done some research, and it's my understanding that program has a five-year lifetime.
Yes, that's correct.
So, you know, what are people to do when, you know, maybe they need help 2 years here, and then they're okay for a while, and... You know, 5 years over your lifetime, you know, children up to 18 years old, you have 5 years of help.
This was Newt Gingrich's baby, and it shows. And this, you know, it was a crime. It was a terrible thing to have done. And not that AFDC, which it replaced, was the best program in the world. You know, there is something to be said for the concept that welfare can produce dependency. But on the other hand, during a time of economic crisis like we have right now, you have to have a social safety net, or you're going to have people, you know, committing suicide, committing crimes, you know, it's just their lives being ruined. We know that if young people don't get decent jobs in the first 5 years after they get out of high school or college, that their lifetime earnings are hundreds of thousands of dollars less than they would have otherwise been. You know, people are putting off having babies. It's just incredible.
Not if the Republicans have anything to say about it, they won't.
Well, at least if they're raped, I suppose. But it's It is. Yeah. I mean, it's just. It is a tragedy. It is absolutely a tragedy. I know so many people my age, Louise, and I know so many people my age, our age, who are saying, you know, hey, my kids are in their 20s and 30s, and they're not having babies because they're afraid to, you know, and I'd like to have grandchildren, you know, but it ain't happening.
I wanted to mention another thing regarding getting a state-issued ID for women.
Yeah.
It is extremely difficult because what your name is today, you have to prove, show documentation how you got to that name.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've been married several times, divorced, you have to produce all that documentation.
Like everybody just kind of keeps that stuff in their wallet, right? or in their purse.
Exactly.
It's
anyway,
insane.
Welcome back, Tom. Glad to have you back. You had great guest host filling in for you.
Thank you, Maureen. Yeah, they
really appreciate your show.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be back. Thank you for your kind words, and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. Thank you, Maureen.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Alan in Prescott, Michigan. Hey, Alan, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio.
Yeah, I wanted to refer you to page 74 of the Romney tax return.
Okay, I don't have page 74 in front of me, so I'll have to take your word for what's on it.
Let me tell you what's there, and I have links on this on my Twitter at GreenSpaceGuy. But on the foreign tax form, which is a form 1116,
right?
You have to list your foreign taxes you paid in the last 10 years.
Right.
That gives us a picture of the fact that in 2008, 2007, Romney had 10 times as much foreign income and paid 10 times as much taxes. Same time the stock market was crashing.
Interesting.
He doesn't want people to know that he had a lot more foreign investments that he probably moved back to the U.S. just before the 2010 tax return was filed.
The thing that I'm really curious about, in 2009, I believe it was, or it might have been the year before, but I think it was 2009, We had this amnesty program where we'd been working on it for a couple of years. It started, you know, this was a Bush initiative that
yes,
if
I'm,
you,
I'm aware of that too.
Yeah. If you were a billionaire and you had stashed money overseas, and they estimated that there was $34 billion that U.S. billionaires had stashed overseas to hide from taxes. And if you had stashed that money overseas to hide it from taxes, there was this one-year amnesty, and I think it was 2009, where if you just came clean and declared that you had, you know, been lying on your forms and you were playing games with your taxes, you would not go to jail. There was a small penalty you would pay, plus you would pay the taxes, and you could get straight with the government. And I'm wondering if the reason why Romney will not release his 2009 tax return is because that would show on that tax return.
There's also another reason. Did you see a Rock Center documentary on the Mormon Church?
No.
Well, the Book of Mormon doesn't believe in taxes to the regular government. And there's a lot of Mormons that
I'm not an expert on Mormonism, but many churches don't believe in any government at all, or at the very least that you should ignore government. I mean, the Catholic Church became the government of most of Europe during most of the 17th, 18th centuries, and actually, you know, from the arguably the 10th century forward. And so you have to wonder if the Mormon religion is following in the footsteps of thinking that, you know, they should basically be the government. I know that there's a Mormon prophecy or belief that a Mormon will become president of the United States, you know, that Jesus visited the United States as a sacred country.
I think that's the White Horse prophecy, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the details.
But Harry Smith was taking a tour of a massive warehouse where the Mormon Church gives food to the members of the church.
Right.
But they write it off as charity. But the members of the church have to work in those places. They get household goods, they get food, so the labor's free. You're basically, they've created
right.
a
but
economy.
You know, let me just clarify. To their credit, anybody can get free food and things from these Mormon organizations. They just have to go to one of the bishops. They have to go to somebody in the church and basically sign up and ask for it. So it's not quite that bad.
You're
Thank
listening
you.
To the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, every religion has their weirdnesses, and I'm not about to indict Romney for being a Mormon. I don't think that that's the wedge we should be using. Tom Hartman here with you, and what a wild day. I mean, the Republican National Convention kicking off in Tampa, sort of, except Mother Nature is saying, you haven't been nice to me. You need to learn about carbon dioxide. But, you know, on they go. Meanwhile, Republicans are desperately trying to rig the November election by kicking millions of Democratic voters off the rolls with the voter suppression laws. And they're not even hiding this. I mean, in the states where they've got, you know, laws where court, they have court orders because they have a history of racially blocking voters based on race. States like Georgia, Arizona, Alabama, South Carolina, South Dakota, Texas. The attorneys general are saying, all Republicans, they filed a brief with the Supreme Court asking that the Voting Rights Act, Martin Luther King's, one of his major achievements, that the Voting Rights Act be struck down in its entirety by Roberts and Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Kennedy. Can you believe that? I mean, this is like, yeah, let's just go back to post-Civil War. You know, if we're going to do that, let's go back to pre-Civil War. I'm beginning to think that Abraham Lincoln, when the South seceded, and Robert E. Lee sent that letter to Abraham Lincoln saying, we are pulling our butts out of this union, and we will see you guys later. We are now the Confederate States of America. And Lincoln actually thought that he would have a three-week war on his hands. He thought he had a bunch of, you know, ragtag rebels who were gonna, he was gonna just, you know, kick their butts up one side and down the other, and that'd be the end of that. He miscalculated. I mean, just like George W. Bush believed that when he invaded Iraq and took down Saddam Hussein, that the war would last less than a week and cost less than $5 billion, and that more money than that would come in from the oil revenue. But in any case, I'm beginning to think that Abraham Lincoln should have just said to Robert E. Lee, fine, see ya. I mean, you know, all our tax dollars, all our federal tax dollars are going to the Republican states in the South. They're the ones with the high levels of poverty. They're the, you know, and all, and the, and who's paying the bill? The Democratic states in the North. Now, I realize I'm broadcasting all across the country. And I have lived in the South. I lived in Atlanta for 13 years. I have two kids who graduated from the University of Georgia. So I'm, you know, I know the South real well, and I'm being facetious. I'm joking. But there are days when you look at some of these Southern politicians and think, you know, not a damn thing has changed in 100 years. Anyhow, did you hear about the Empire State shooting spree? You know, this guy shot his employer at the Empire State Building. The guy fired him. He shot him. Cops show up. He never shot at the cops. I mean, he may have intended to, but he didn't. But the cops shot at him, and in the process of shooting at him, they shot 9 bystanders. 9 people standing around, falling to the ground, you know, wounded, bleeding, dying, whatever. The cops shot 9 people in the process of killing this one guy. Now, police officers are well trained in how to use their weapons. They have to qualify on a shooting range. They have to file piles of paperwork before they even pull their gun out, and they know it, and they'd rather not do it, especially if they discharge it. They are, you know, as professional as you can get in the United States right now. And they shot 9 bystanders. And idiots at the NRA and people like this want us to think that if when that crazy guy had walked into that theater armed with his AR-14 and his grenades and everything else, that if that guy, that if only everybody in the theater had a gun, everything would have been wonderful. When a group of top-trained police officers trying to take out one shooter hit 9 bystanders, can you imagine the carnage that would have happened in that theater in Aurora, Colorado, if everybody in that theater, or if a significant number of people in that theater have been carrying weapons, especially if they were not police officers who had to qualify regularly on a rifle round, a shooting range? It just blows my mind. The Brits, by the way, have backed off on their threat to storm the Ecuadorian embassy, but they are saying that if Julian Assange gets, even though he has diplomatic status now, so he should be able to walk out to a car, take the car to the airport, get on an Ecuadorian airline, and fly out, the Brits are not going to acknowledge that. It's pretty amazing. Mick in Chicago. Hey, Mick. What's up?
Hi, Tim. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's on your mind?
I'm calling regards to this myth that these right-wingers always put on about the Kennedy tax cuts creating, expanding the economy.
Right.
I'm going by the OMB historical data. And from when Kennedy did those tax cuts, we were in the middle of a nine-year expansion of the economy. The tax revenues went up in 1962, 9%. They went up in 1963, 3.2%. When the Kennedy tax cuts took effect, they went up only 0.9% in 64 and went down in 1965, minus 1.5%. Now, this is when the economy is expanding. That doesn't happen often. Yeah. When tax revenues go down, when the GDP is actually going up. And the same thing happened with the Reagan era. And from 81, when he did that tax cut, it took like 5 years to recover to the previous, to hit the same revenue receipts.
You are absolutely right.
This is constant dollars. Republicans don't use constant dollars. They always use non-adjustable inflated dollars.
Right.
But when you use constant dollars, it's a whole different story, and they don't use that, which is actually the way you're supposed to measure it.
Yeah, you are absolutely right. And by the way, it wasn't Kennedy who reduced taxes. He was dead by then. It was Lyndon Johnson. It was Kennedy who proposed it, though. Yeah.
Right. It was from him. That's when it kicked in 64.
And he actually proposed raising taxes, and he was quite clear about that. He wanted to lower the top marginal rate because he was one of those rich guys, and he knew that nobody was actually paying that 91% rate. So
right.
He said, let's cut that rate down to 74% and let's do away with all the loopholes that let people get away with paying nothing or paying 20% or whatever.
Exactly.
And that's what he proposed was to
do. Yeah, he was not a supply sider at all.
No, not at all. In fact, he was quite clear about it. I can play the tape right now, although we don't need to. I've done it so many times. Most of my listeners have it memorized. But from his debates with Richard Nixon, where he said, I intend to increase revenues. In other words, raise taxes.
Exactly.
And then he goes on to say what he's going to do with it. We're going to use those revenues to build more schools. We're going to use them to build more hospitals. We're going to use them to improve our roads. We're going to build, he just went through the list.
Exactly.
And improve housing.
Right. And see, Republicans, they lie, like the old saying, you lie often enough, people start believing it. And these Republicans, they have to be refuted every time they bring up Kennedy because they seem to get away with this all the time.
Yeah.
It's very
yeah.
frustrating.
Well, the problem that I had with that guy is that it was like, I don't want to call them untruths because I don't want to, he's not here to defend himself, but people make five misstatements, shall we say, in a row, in a single sentence.
Begin?
And you got to pick which one you're going to respond
to. Right. This is too much, you got to.
So Nick, thank you for calling and setting the record straight and taking it one more step. I truly appreciate it. Bill in Albany, Georgia. Hey, speaking of Georgia, hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just want to talk a second about the Republicans talking about deregulation. They want to deregulate everything and they want to do away with the EPA. And all that. And
well, wait a minute. They do not want to deregulate women's bodies.
No, but I'm just the people like in West Virginia that are being hurt badly by the coal mines. They're taking the mountains away.
Yeah.
And then you got in Pennsylvania the people being they can't even drink their water because of the fracturing from the gas being drilled there, and their lives are being ruined. I mean. The Democrats need to start showing these people and put real people in front of the camera and saying, look, this is who these are the people that are being affected, okay,
right.
by these people making money and by, there has to be something where you don't have to hurt people in order to get energy,
right.
what I mean? Or there has to be something else to be done. And I'm a disabled vet. I get SSI, which I barely make it every month.
Sure.
And then they also want to start doing away with food stamps. I'll tell you, for me, if I don't have food stamps, that means I'm not going to eat hardly at all during the month. So, there's a lot. The Republicans scare me to death the way they're talking about all the things they want to do away with.
Yeah. They want
and
a country out buying for rich people, and the rest of us are, please, Mr. Cratchit, may I have a lump of coal? No, you may not.
It's just horrible. I'm just, and they're supposed to be so religious and everything else and that, but it's such a,
Can you imagine if Jesus was a Republican? And, you know, when they brought Lazarus to him, he said, do you have an insurance policy for this? I'm not sure I'm going to raise this guy from the dead. Let's negotiate a price for this. I mean, it's incredible. It's just incredible. Thanks a lot for the call, Bill. Well said. They call themselves religious. I don't believe it for a second. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with what's going on from the Talk Radio News Service and the whole RNC thing. And then in the next hour, an incredible conversation on the Obama's second New Deal. It's Talk Media for the sane among us. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. 10 minutes before the hour. We are live today from Washington, D.C., and we will, throughout the week, next week, we will be bringing you guests from, you know, live from Tampa and live from Charlotte, yeah, as the conventions roll along. I'm slowly catching up on a couple of, when that thing popped inside me, And I thought I was dying. I was moving in that direction. Looking back on it now, there's a week of my life that I just basically don't remember. It's just other than being in the hospital and having all these tubes and, you know, blood and everything else. And man, thank God I'm here. Literally. Donna in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Donna, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm glad I was able to get through to you, and I thank God that he brought you through that so that you can be a voice to people.
Amen, Donna.
So thank you for what you do. I wanted to bring up a point. Everybody talks about Mitt Romney's taxes, but, you know, and he's made a big point, so is Ann, about their donation. They give their 10% tithe that they're supposed to.
Right.
But I don't know how many people realize that one half of his donation that he made in 2010, the only tax return he released, was 1.5 in market value of stock. Therefore, he gave, we don't know what his cost of the stock was.
Right.
So let's just suppose in reality, most people, when they do that, he gave away stock. He may have paid a half of it in cost. He eliminated his taxes on the appreciation of that stock. And the church, being a tax-exempt organization, pays no taxes.
Right. So who gets screwed,
stock,
you and me?
Him giving stock is actually another way for him to avoid paying income taxes.
Right. No capital gains on the stock because he's giving it away.
No capital gains, and the church doesn't have to pay taxes on it either.
Yeah. Interesting point. It's and another reason why I think that outside of monasteries, churches should no longer be tax-exempt organizations, but that's a whole different debate. Donna, thank you for sharing that thought with us.
That's a good point about why he should be releasing his taxes.
Yeah.
People should know that he is using every means possible to avoid paying taxes, using every loophole there is, and yet he wants to be our president.
Yeah, yeah. And I personally have a problem with that. Donna, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to us down there in Baton Rouge on Sirius. Donna, listening to WCPT in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. Hey, Donna, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. I'm just so glad you're back, and you sound great.
Thank you. I feel alive.
Thank God. Well, you know, I wanted to ask you about a creative problem solution. It's been bouncing around in my head for the last couple of days, and, you know, considering that voter suppression is just rampant. Mm-hmm. And understanding that getting to election is the most vital part of the transition of our government.
Mm-hmm.
And what I really think we need to do is just everyone turns out the anniversary, Susan B. Anthony's voting, the 19th Amendment, her penalty of $100, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just all show up, let them arrest us, have a DOJ attorney with us, get this in the court system. I just feel like outside of asking you and inspectors, we have to do something and challenge this.
Yeah, yeah.
So
this should be the province of the Attorney General, Eric Holder. And because it's fairly clear to me that what we're seeing is voter suppression, and that should be illegal. Part of the problem is that he has not been as aggressive on this as frankly I think he should be. And part of the problem is that we have a long history of the Supreme Court and the executive branch turning a blind eye to voter suppression. I mean, literally, that goes back to Reconstruction, to after the Civil War.
Right.
And, Congress had to amend the Constitution three times, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, just to basically force a situation so that freed slaves could vote, and, among other things. And so I think that we're seeing the fruits of that right now. But, yeah, something should be done, and there are grassroots organizations that are working on this, and I encourage you, MoveOn.org is one of them, and I encourage you to participate with them and call your elected members of Congress and say that you oppose these Republican efforts of voter suppression. And call the White House comment line. There's also a petition over at change.org, and if you can get 25,000 people on that petition, the president will read it and respond to it. We need to be talking about this stuff. We really need to be talking about this stuff.
Well, thanks. I really, truly believe that you speak for so many of us who are so frustrated.
Yeah. Well, we got to turn that frustration into action. Donna, thank you for the call. Very well said. Dolores, do I have that right? Dolores in Portland?
D.
Oh, D. Hey, D, what's up?
Well, Tom, it's so nice to see you back.
Thank you.
And maybe this is a bad way to start, but I have a disagreement with you.
Okay.
And I'd like you to give it some consideration.
I will.
When the person called up and he was talking, and I have a question, too, before I hang up.
We have just a minute before the end of this hour, Dee.
Okay, and he was talking about the Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to give you some information as to what their belief system was, what they did, and you wanted to cut him off because you did not want to go into church bashing, and I understand that. But what I don't understand is, are there certain places we can look at the truth and certain places that we can't?
Well,
and then what I've come to glean and understand from the Mormon Church, they are big business people.
They what?
And so they and Mitt Romney is associated with them in a business sense as well as a spiritual sense.
Oh, they're business
people. They are partners. They share a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if Mitt Romney is going to be benefiting from becoming the president of the United States, then the Mormon Church stands to gain a lot, too. So I think, in all fairness, and if you say, look at a man and don't look at his religion, but then religion should get out of politics.
Well, I agree with you, Dee. And I also agree with you that if Mitt Romney becomes president, it's going to be a big boon, a big help, both financially and in terms of membership and everything else for the Mormon Church. I do agree with you. The reason I cut that guy off before, I'll tell you later. We're out of time. I'm sorry. Thank you, Dee.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What if Barack Obama actually created a new deal? What if he created a fundamental change in America in a way that, a real meaningful, non-rhetorical, non-political, a real fundamental change in America? And succeeded and did it and put it into law and got it going. Well, Michael Grunwald is with us. He is the author. He's, first of all, the senior national correspondent for Time magazine, a guy with incredible credibility in these issues. But he's the author, more importantly, of a new book called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era. And we had him on our TV show last week or a couple weeks back. And Michael, it is an honor and pleasure to have you here on our radio program as well.
Oh, thanks so much for your kind words.
Michael, tell us about the Obama stimulus package and how this was more than simply, throwing some spaghetti at the wall and hoping something sticks and, the way it's been largely portrayed.
Right. No, it's been covered as this $800 billion joke that's full of, you know, mob museums and levitating trains to Disneyland and all kinds of other nonsense that is not in the actual bill. What it did, the bill was called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. And what it did was it sort of sparked a recovery as well as long-term reinvestment. It really did prevent a depression. The GDP had fallen 9% in the fourth quarter of 2008. At that level, at that rate, you lose an entire Canadian economy in 2009. But after losing 800,000 jobs the month Obama took over, the next month after he passes the stimulus and the next quarter, they have the biggest improvement in jobs in 30 years.
Wow.
So it really did prevent something awful. But at the same time, this was really the purest distillation of what Obama meant by change. This is where, excuse me, I'm at the Republican convention, so, you know, they're playing this music.
That's fine. I understand perfectly. The ambiance is just great. Go for it, Michael.
What I was going to say is that this is where Obama got to keep all those big promises he had made on the campaign trail about moving to a clean energy economy and reforming education and starting to reduce our health care costs and investing in infrastructure and research and cutting middle-class taxes. He did all this stuff with that $800 billion, but nobody really noticed it.
Now, you're the senior national correspondent for Time magazine. If it's true that Barack Obama actually did something that was as significant as the Great Society or the New Deal, or in the range of that, why wasn't it on the cover of Time magazine? Not to, you know, say that you have any responsibility for that. And why has the rest of the media largely ignored it?
You know, it's a really good question. Look, part of it is that, you know, that this was, you know, the country was sort of like Wile E. Coyote after we step off the cliff.
Yeah.
But we're, you know, sort of looking left and right, but haven't yet started to fall.
Right.
I mean, unemployment wasn't that high when Obama took over. And so there was this sense that, unlike FDR, who took over after 3 years of depression that everybody knew was Hoover's depression, you know, Obama took over, passes this big jobs bill, and then suddenly the jobless rate starts increasing. It just, you know, it's hard to explain that jobs are a lagging indicator, you know, that things would have been so much worse. That makes a lousy bumper sticker. So I think part of it was just the circumstances out of control. Then you had this relentless Republican campaign of distortion, where they were very unified and very smart and very dishonest in the way they described this thing as just, you know, a big government mess. And then you had the media that really was not interested in getting at the truth, partly because, you know, it was sort of a he said, she said story, and you had Republicans saying that it was a mess. And on the other hand, you kind of had Democrats saying it was a mess. You know, it's not big enough, or there are too many tax cuts.
Well, but you had, you're right. There was a he said, she said, right. But there were also actual real facts and statistics. You've included
right.
them in your
well,
book
not,
at some length. Why
no,
wasn't
not,
anybody
not
paying attention to those?
You know, look, I think it's just, this is a, you know, I live in South Beach now, you know, that public policy paradise.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that if I still lived in, I spent 9 years at the Washington Post, and I think if I still live in D.C., I'm not sure I could have written this book because the groupthink is so strong. It's exactly what led to the, you know, the way the media missed the story before the Iraq War,
right.
Where anybody who talks about the Recovery Act is anything other than this joke. You've got to just sort of roll your eyes and sneer. It's like you're, you know, you're not cool. You don't get it. I love my bosses, but when I first pitched to them in 2010 that I wanted to write this kind of revisionist story about the stimulus, I don't know if you watched The Newsroom, but I was like that blogger who's always trying to pitch a story about how Bigfoot is real.
Yeah, I keep hearing about it. I haven't seen the show yet, but I'll take your story.
It seems so preposterous when, you know, the conventional wisdom, the prevailing narrative was so set in stone. With all due respect to my colleagues in Washington, they're not very interested in public policy. They're interested in, you know, how's the president doing? And because unemployment was rising, the president was, his numbers weren't very good. And then the narrative just becomes sort of piling on, where you had these ridiculous gotcha stories with no gotcha, where the stimulus was treated as this kind of fleecing of America story instead of a story about sort of changing the way we approach America's most intractable problems.
Amazing. So where is the American Stimulus and Recovery Act, if I'm remembering correctly the title of it? Where does it stand today?
Well, you know, most of the money has been spent, and it's been, you know, it's really been a remarkable success.
The most of the money is not spent?
No, most of the money has been spent.
Has been spent, okay.
It's been amazing. You know, before the stimulus, independent experts predicted that about 5 to 7% of it would be lost to fraud. They put the toughest investigator in Washington in charge of overseeing it. And after 3 years, when he left, the total fraud had came out to 0.001%. We've already doubled renewable energy in this country because of the stimulus. It was dead in the water before the Recovery Act. We've jump-started a smart grid. We've created an advanced battery industry for electric vehicles out of thin air. So now we have the capacity to build 500,000 electric cars in this country. We've started to transform our pen and paper healthcare system into the digital age so that your doctor won't kill you with his pen and paper, you know, with his chicken scratch handwriting when he writes out a prescription. You know, we're really starting to see this change. 95% of working people in America got a tax cut, although less than 10% of Americans are aware of it. 7 million people have been lifted out of poverty. 1.2 million people were prevented from homelessness by this new program that really is designed to prevent homelessness before it happens. It's really been sort of one success story after another, but those stories really haven't been told.
And obviously you're out there telling the story. You wrote a book on it, and you're here on our program, and you're doing the best to promote the book, but is there anybody else telling this story? You would think that the Obama campaign would be doing this. We have a minute to the end of the segment here, sir.
You know, it's funny. I always joke that, you know, maybe my book will become a runaway bestseller and everybody will know about this. But as you said, I've been a mainstream media reporter for 20 years. You know, I've been tough on Republicans and Democrats, but suddenly I've written this book and it's like I can't get on, you know, only MSNBC wants to have me on and your show very generously. And I'm not knocking it. I'm thrilled to go out and sort of preach to the converted too. But it's been very tough getting this message out because it's sort of not what Washington wants to hear. And frankly, Obama, who is a politician, he's in no mood to tell the story either because, you know, the stimulus a year after it passed, even though every independent economist will say that it created about 3 million jobs, the percentage of Americans who believe it created jobs is lower than the percentage who believe Elvis is alive. So they just feel like Obama told his economic team, look, I get the Keynesian thing, but it's not where the electorate is. And they're not really interested in trying to convince Americans otherwise. They have a different message they're trying to get out.
This is such an opportunity lost. Michael Gruenwald, check out the book. This is really brilliant. It's a book worth buying. It's called The New Deal, The Hidden Story of Change in the Obama Era by Michael Gruenwald. Michael, thank you for being with us.
Well, I really appreciate what you said about
this
it, and I really
do
hope people
Hartman
read
program.
It, because even the converted might be surprised by what they read.
Yeah, there's a lot of great substance in this book. Michael, thank you again. One of the finest boys around is a guy by the name of David Cobb, who's out there doing the good work, doing the Lord's work, as they say, every single day, trying to amend our Constitution to say money is property. It's not speech. And corporations are corporations. They're not people. And he's doing it over at movetoamend.org. You've heard me singing this mantra for years. I will continue to do so several times a week. In fact, at least once or twice a week, we end one of our daily takes with go to movetoamend.org on our TV show, and we do it a lot on the radio show here as well. And, David, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you so much, Tom, and let me just join the chorus of voices welcoming you back.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's nice being back, boy, do I have empathy now for people who've had surgery where something went wrong. You are the national spokesperson for Move to Amend. You're an attorney. You're the national projects director of Democracy Unlimited. You're a former candidate for president of the United States in the Green Party in 2004. I have here as topic written down, democratic process hangs in the balance in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What's going on in Milwaukee?
Well, Tom, as you know, Move to Amend has helped lots of communities, cities pass resolutions calling for an abolishment of the illegitimate court-created idea that corporations have constitutional rights and to amend the Constitution to make it clear that money is not speech so that it can be regulated. More importantly, we've passed non-binding advisory opinions in 7 jurisdictions where the people have been able to actually weigh in on this. Every place we put on the ballot, it wins by supermajorities, including in conservative jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. We were so excited on July 26th of this year, just last month, when the Milwaukee County executive put on or passed by a vote of 14-4 a commitment to put it on the ballot in November in Milwaukee. Over 1 million people then, and the largest jurisdiction to actually be able to be voting on it. And we have only until the end of the day tomorrow for County Executive Chris Abley to actually sign that. We thought that it was a done deal, but we're finding out that County Executive Chris Abley may refuse to take this to the ballot. It's completely, I don't understand it.
One guy is obstructing it. So what's the pressure point? What can our viewers and our callers do and our listeners do?
Please, first of all, if you live within Milwaukee, if you're one of the million folks there, please call Chris Abley, email the county executive. I think that there is still time. In fact, I know there's still time because he has until the end of the day tomorrow to actually sign.
Now, his name is Chris E.B.
public referendum.
Chris E-B-E-L-E, A-B-E-L-E. That's how he spells his last name. A-B-E-L-E. Okay.
Correct. And the thing is, Tom, we are going to already be on the ballot in another half dozen, maybe 10 jurisdictions. But what's so incredible is that Milwaukee is a multiracial city. It's 1 million folks. It is a majority ethnic minority. This would be really a tremendous effort on our part at Move to Amend to take it to the next level. And we are encouraging County Executive Abley to allow us to applaud him for helping to facilitate this growing democracy movement. But if he fails to do so, there will be repercussions because this, as you know, Tom, is cutting across party lines. It's cutting across ideologies. This is a democracy movement that's sweeping the country. And we say to our elected officials, please come and join us. Or get out of the way.
Yeah, on this program, I've had Tea Partiers who are just as enthusiastic about what you're doing as are the occupiers.
You know, Tom, I have the same experience. I literally have Tea Party supporters, members, come up to me after my public presentations, invite me back to their community, and not to come back to a Unitarian congregation or to a union hall, but to invite me back specifically to speak for a Tea Party event.
Yeah.
It is really exciting to be able to be building this grassroots movement where we cut across party lines and say, look, this is not an issue. This is a principle of how our democratic republic operates. And because Move to Amend is the only coalition to say that only human beings have constitutional rights, we're not going to create any exemptions for nonprofits or any other artificial entities, that has been the calling card that's allowed us to be able to make such great collaboration with principled liberals and principled conservatives.
Now, Chris Abley, A-B-E-L-E, is the county executive in Milwaukee who has not so far signed the paper to put your referendum on the ballot, even though you got the signatures and all that kind of thing. You all set. Has he given a reason why he has not done this?
Well, the first time he said that it was a concern about $19,000 to add the printing cost to add this simple question to a ballot. Remember, Tom, we're not asking for a special election. This would simply be on the ballot in November on the regular ballot. A quick aside, I think it's really puzzling to me why a Democrat would not want to actually, in a swing state, would not want to have something on the ballot that plays so strong.
This guy's a Democrat?
Yes.
Huh. Amazing.
Yeah, well, there you go, Tom. But so $19,000. I also want to put this into perspective. The Milwaukee County annual budget is $1.2 billion. We're talking about 1/600,000th of an amount of the total budget with, and get this, Tom, there is already an $11 million annual surplus.
Wow.
I have
the phone number for the county executive's office in Milwaukee. Would it be a good idea for me to put it out on the air right now?
I think you should, Tom. Let's let him know that there are folks who would actually like to like to have Milwaukee County voters.
Okay, and let me give a heads up to Sue running our chat room as well so that she can copy it down and put it into our newsletter. And say that again. 2784211. Okay. It is 414-278-4211. Area code 414-278-4211. And ask the county executive to please put this ballot question on the ballot. Put this thing on the ballot. Right, David?
You nailed it, Tom, as usual.
Okay, hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
A, David Cobb, thanks for your great work. And B, 414, write this down, 414-278-4211. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And time for our cheesy news alert by Andy Borowitz. Tip of the hat to Andy, andyborowitz.com. The Republican National Committee issued a statement today indicating that due to Hurricane Isaac, the war on women would be postponed until Tuesday. Billy Coldain, who traveled from Bullitt County, Kentucky, to attend the war on women, was just one of many Republicans who said they were disgusted by the party's decision. Party is saying they're going to do this because of an act of God, he said. But postponing the war on women is the exact opposite of what God would want. Sometimes I wonder if Republicans are really serious about defeating women, end quote. He worried that postponing the war on women, quote, because of a little 100-mile-an-hour wind, end quote, might be seen as by the party's enemies as a sign of weakness. He says, there's rotten weather every December, and you don't see Obama postponing the war on Christmas. God bless Andy Borowitz. He is just one of the funniest guys out there. Okay, some of Mitt Romney's positions, just so you know, and then I'll pick up your calls here. But here's on adoption. I know many gay couples who are able to adopt children. That's fine. Obviously, that's their right. He said that in 2007, 2012. I simply acknowledge the fact that gay adoption is legal. On Ronald Reagan, 1994. I was an independent during the time of Reagan-Bush. I am not trying to return to Reagan-Bush. 2006, when I was running for office first time in 94, I was trying to define who I was. I've said since and continue to reiterate that one of my heroes is Ronald Reagan. On working mothers, even if you have a child 2 years of age, you need to go to work. And people said, well, that's heartless. I happen to believe, that was in 2012, he said, I happen to believe that all moms are working moms. See, it's just like having it both ways, right? Campaign finance. When campaigns spend the kind of money they're now spending, I think that's wrong. I would like to have campaign spending limits. Mitt Romney, 1994. Today, the American people should be free to advocate for their candidates and their positions without burdensome limitations. Bin Laden, 2007. It's not worth moving heaven and earth, spending billions of dollars just to try to catch one person. 2011. We're delighted that he gave the order to take out Osama bin Laden. Any president would have done that. Right. Gun violence. In 1994, I don't line up with the NRA. We do have tough gun laws in Massachusetts. I support them. I supported the assault weapon ban. More recently, I support the work of the NRA. I am a member of the NRA. I don't support any gun control legislation. Tax pledge. I'm not intending to, at this stage, sign a document which would prevent me from being able to look specifically at any of the revenue needs in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This is 2002. Now, I'm proud to be the only major candidate for president to sign the tax pledge. Right. He once said, I'm not in favor of privatizing Social Security or making cuts. Then a little later he said, President Bush said, let's have private accounts. That works. Climate change. I believe the world's getting warmer. I believe that humans contribute to that, and I think it's important for us to reduce our emissions of pollutants and greenhouse gases. And then he changed his mind. My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on the planet, and the idea of spending trillions and trillions of dollars to reduce CO2 emissions is not the right course for us. I mean, pick a topic. You know, Medicare savings, Romney Care, campaign lies, abortion, rape, flip-flopping. I'm a strong believer in staying in your position and not wavering, he says. Right. I've been as consistent as human beings can be. I'm not going to go through the whole list here. You can find it online. I mean, it's just, in fact, The Economist, you know, The Economist, the conservative economic magazine published out of the UK, The Economist published an op-ed titled, "So Mitt, What Do You Really Believe?" And they say, this newspaper finds much to like in the history of this uncharismatic but dogged man, from his obvious business acumen to the way he worked across the political aisle. We share many of his views about the excessive gross regulation. After 4 years of soaring oratory and intermittent reforms, why not bring in a more businesslike figure? But competence is worthless without direction and, frankly, character. The Economist saying Romney has no character. Would the candidate Romney would had indeed presented himself as a solid chief executive of things who got things done. Instead, he has appeared as a fawning PR man, apparently willing to do or say just about anything to get elected. In some areas, notably social policy and foreign affairs, the result is that he is now committed to needlessly extreme or dangerous courses that he may not actually believe in but will find hard to drop. In others, especially to do with the economy, the lack of detail means that some attractive-sounding headline policies prove meaningless and possibly dangerous on closer inspection. Behind all this sits the worrying idea of a man who does not really know his own mind. America won't vote for that man, nor would this newspaper. Wow. And then it goes on for two more pages. That's The Economist. I don't think The Economist has ever failed to endorse a Republican. That's mind-boggling. And true. What can you say? It's true. Rich in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Rich, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm really glad that you're back on the air, and I think you're one of the best political analysts out there in the business.
Well, thank you for your kind words. I'm pleased to be back.
My biggest fear is that a Republican will be naming the next Supreme Court justice.
Yes, that's my biggest fear, too.
It would be a disaster.
And not just the next one, but the next three ones.
Yeah, it would be a total disaster when they believe things like corporations are people and money is speech.
And the earth is flat and started 6,000 years ago. And yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I have a suggestion for the people, the political activists in Tampa, whether they're Occupy movement people or just, you know, good old straight-ahead Democrats. Mm-hmm. Go to the nearest, you know, busy intersection that's closest to the convention as soon as the weather, you know, lets up, and hold up a sign that says, "Romney, show us your worth certificates." The 1040 long forms, and just keep the pressure on him to you know, release his tax returns, because right. I think once everyone sees how little this guy pays and therefore how little he cares about the country that allowed him to become rich, there's no way that we could elect a man like that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you at all, and the Democrats, I think, are gonna keep on this issue, so. You know, we'll see how it plays out. Rich, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. Ron in Mays Landing, New Jersey. Do I have that right, Ron?
That's it.
Hey, what's up?
Yeah, I was telling your producer it's a real off-the-wall concept, but when you were talking about corporations and people,
mm-hmm.
If they truly are people, would someone who bankrupts the corporation, read Mitt Romney, be considered a murderer?
He's killed off a couple of companies, and he's made a lot of money doing it. So not just a murderer, but a murderer for hire? I don't think so, frankly.
True in some cases.
Yeah. See, in my opinion, the idea that a corporation is a person, even though Mitt Romney believes it apparently, is so laughable that, let's not even go there. So, you what you have, you know, it's like the people who call and say, well, if a corporation's a person, you know, can, when it merges with another corporation, is that a marriage? And if it merges with two of them, is that a polygamous marriage? And, you know, right. What if they're the same sex, and how do you know? And when you end a corporation, should you have a funeral? And when you birth a corporation, should there be a shower? And I mean, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And
should it be raised the religion of the mother?
Yeah, there you go. So you're pointing it out right. Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. How you doing, my buddy?
Hey, buddy. I'm glad you're better, and I'm glad you're back.
Thank you. Yeah, you've been through this hospital thing before, haven't you?
Oh, Jesus. I'd call it a nightmare, and, you know.
Yeah, I know. You had a heart problem, as I recall.
They didn't put a blood pressure monitor on me, and I was going into shock and dying. If my wife hadn't been there, my blood pressure went down to almost like 40 or 60.
Mine went down to 71 over 44.
Well, you got to the threshold of the other side, didn't you?
I guess.
I don't like it either.
They were asking me questions like, what's your name? Where are you?
I'm afraid, you know, I don't want to go and go, oh, my God, there's Bush and Romney.
Yeah.
I know where I went. Anyway.
So what's up, Armin?
There's two good shows. Back in the 90s, before the telecommunications bill in 96, we still had a lot of media information out there in the mainstream media, unlike now we have to get it through the Internet.
Yeah.
And Joanne Stone, in the early 90s, it was about 94, 95, she did a show called Biography, and it was on Rupert Murdoch and how he came from, you know, where he came from, the other country, and,
right.
and
Australia.
Where he raised his money. He raised his money from Vegas. He went to Vegas.
Really?
And then there was a history show series right after that that had the history of Vegas. And the history show more or less said that the Mormons bailed out the mafia. They didn't use the word mafia, but when
right.
the mafia was going under in the 50s, the Mormons came to the rescue with the capital to keep Vegas alive. So you put all this together, look how incredibly rich they're getting with the propaganda arm, which is Murdoch.
I can't speak to that. I can tell you, though, that Richard Nixon was just totally mobbed up, you know, with all kinds of money. Mickey Cohen out of Vegas and all these other guys. Amazing. Armin, thanks for the
You're
call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The Empire State Building shooting. The police shot 9 people by accident, bystanders. What would have happened if everybody was armed in Aurora, Colorado?
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9 years I've been doing this show. I've never taken a vacation. and then, anyhow, I'm back. And I'm very, very glad to be back. And we'll just leave it at that. By the way, once again, the phone number for the Milwaukee County executive, Chris Abell, who needs to sign this referendum so that Milwaukee County voters can express their opinion on the role of money in politics, is 414-278-4211. 414-278-4211. And so if you're in Milwaukee, if you're a constituent of Chris Abell, and this is, the guy's a Democrat, you know, don't be calling it angry, right? You know, be respectful. But say, please put this thing on the referendum. We need to have these things on the referendum. Paul in Detroit. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hey, Tom. I'm glad you're back.
Thank you.
And I'm also glad that you have 3 excellent pinch hitters.
Yeah, we had some absolutely great fill-in hosts in Mike Papantonio and Carl Frisch and in Mike Newcomb. Just spectacular. And I'm very, very grateful to all 3 of them.
Yeah. I think I know... Why the media ignores all of Obama's accomplishments, and it's the same reason that they ignore all Bush's lies and Romney's lies, and that's that they're owned entirely by, you know, corporate billionaires. And I mean, if you're a selfish billionaire who doesn't want to pay taxes, you're going to do what Rupert Murdoch does, and that's just hire Republican stooges to work for you, and that's pretty much what they do.
I think there's a large element of truth to that. I think there's also a dynamic, and I've seen, you know, I'm in the media here. I've seen it in the media over the years, that when you hit a certain level, which is basically when you've got your own show or when you're a regular host on one of the networks, your income goes from the, you know, $100,000 a year to maybe a couple $100,000 a year of a, you know, of a major talk show host, or even sometimes it's less than that, but whatever. It suddenly jumps to millions.
Right.
All of a sudden, these guys are, you know, their income, I mean, like, you know, in a week, suddenly goes to $2, 3, 4, 5 million a year. And they know that the only way they can continue making that kind of money is if Tom DeLay will keep coming back on their show, or Mitch McConnell will keep coming back on their show. So, you know, if they call them out in a way that actually draws blood, you know, that hurts them, then that person's going to say, I won't be back on your show. I've had a number of people, you know, a number of right-wingers in this program where I actually fought with them. I mean, you know, courteously, but actually took them on and spoke the truth, who have called back to Sean, our producer, who is, you know, long-suffering and one of the hardest-working people I know, and she's the real one of the real stars of this show. She puts in so much work, Sean Taylor. God bless her. And have called her up saying, I am never going to go on that program again, thinking that by doing so, they're hurting me. But, you know, I'm not in that elevated strata, right? You know, I mean, we've got this small business here, and we, you know, spread the money around among the people who work here and whatnot. And it's just, you know, it ain't happening. It doesn't matter to me, right?
Yeah,
you know,
me neither.
Yeah. So it's, but you know, I could see those same people calling up, you know, one of the major people who have shows on the major networks, particularly on the cable networks, calling a producer and saying, you know, if I'm asked this question, I won't come back on the show. And that's why, you know, Romney is now asking reporters, don't ask this question. And some of the reporters, there was this one reporter a couple days ago who came out by name and said, Romney said that if I ask a question about Aiken, I couldn't interview him, so I chose not to interview him. And I predicted at the time, now I wasn't, maybe I don't think I was on the air at that time. I don't think it was last Thursday. I think it was last Friday. But I said to Louise, lacking any other audience, we talk a lot. And I said, I'll bet that this reporter is that she's just shot herself in the foot with, you know, with regard to her career. And so I think that there's a large element of the, yeah, they're giant corporations and they're looking out for corporate interests. But there's also this, you know, this kind of media star thing that didn't exist during the Walter Cronkite days. It didn't exist back before the infotainment, before 86, the Telecommunications Act, when radio and TV stations and news operations went from news to infotainment. So I think that's a piece of it. But anyhow, Paul, thanks a lot for the call. Let me try and get another call in here. We have just a minute before the show wraps up. Andre in Jersey City, New Jersey, listening on WWRL. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, how you doing there, Tom? I just want to, you know, I had received some literature in the mail from a religious organization that's supposed to be saving America. And it, on the front page of the, on the cover of the small magazine, it said, if Jesus were alive, how would he vote?
Right.
And, I mean, it was just so disturbing when I read it, because I'm like, how is it that these people say that, like, you listen to some of these pastors, I'm not broad brushing all of them, but these so-called Christians that are just the entirely opposite end of the spectrum of what the scripture, how they live and what the scripture says.
Yeah.
So you have pastors saying, well, America was built on spiritual principles. And I'm like, okay, if that is the case, that America was built on spiritual principles, how was genocide endorsed? I mean, when you think of the Native Americans, was that spiritual principle?
Yeah, we've got a lot. Andre, I've got to cut you off because we're at the end of the hour, but thank you for the call. But you're right, we have a lot to answer for in this country. On the other hand, we've come a long way, and I think we've got a long way to go, but we need to be moving forward. Coming up next on the Tom Harbin program, more news and guests from the RNC convention in Tampa as the events get underway. plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you join one of these grassroots organizations and say, yes, I'm part of it. Tag, you're it. Get out
You've
there, get out.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.